On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Remedy Selection for Contaminated Sediments. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Remediation Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Remediation Team. Today's training is based on a web-based guidance document, and we have a link here on slide 2 to this guidance document. We're going to introduce you to the document during today's training, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training class. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to go over as we get started. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording the training. The trainers are going to control the slides today, but if you would like to control your own slides, you can go to that CLUIN training page where you started today. It's also available in the middle right as a related URL. And to access those related URLs, you select the name, and then you select Browse To. That's going to allow you to open those URLs in a new window. We do look for your questions and feedback throughout today's training class. You're welcome to send in a question or a comment in the Q&A box. We're going to have breaks, one in the middle and another at the end of the training class, and we will ask questions out loud and have our trainers respond to those questions. In some cases, we're going to respond right back to you in that Q&A pod, especially if you're having technical difficulties. We'll try to get right back to you with a quicker answer on those. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information and appreciate you taking a few minutes to give us your feedback. One of the features that is available now through the feedback form only is that you can create a certificate of participation for yourself. So if you are interested in a certificate, fill out the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. And once you submit that, the system will create a certificate for you, and it'll be available on the next page, and it'll also be emailed to you. So that is a feature now available only through the feedback form. So at the end of the class, please be sure to fill out the feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. Today's contaminated sediments training was developed by the ITRC team that was made up of state local government, private industry, federal government, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from the public and tribal stakeholders and academia. More information about ITRC is available on the website. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. I'm going to introduce our trainers for today. All trainers are members of the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Remediation Team. That team was led by John Cargill from Delaware and Greg Newman from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. John Cargill is our first trainer today. He's a hydrogeologist with the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control located in Newcastle. He oversees contamination assessment and cleanup projects conducted by responsible parties and also designs and implements state-led assessment and remediation projects, including contaminated sediments projects. Steve Clough is a senior environmental toxicologist at Haley and Aldrich in Manchester, New Hampshire. He has conducted numerous multi-pathway ecological risk assessments that require formulating conceptual models which are validated in the field by sampling of sediments and biota to determine the actual exposure and risk that environmental chemicals stressors may pose to key receptors. Paul Duty is a principal engineer at Anchor QEA in Syracuse, New York. He is expert in multiple facets of contaminated sediments management, including remedial investigation and feasibility studies, treatability studies, remedial design, remedial construction oversight, and environmental monitoring. Eric Blitzky is a senior environmental scientist with CDM Smith in Portland, Oregon. His work is focused on contaminated sediments, and he is a technical resource for numerous sediment cleanup projects around the country and participates in a variety of national sediment forums. Bhavna Sharma is an environmental engineer with CH2M Hill located in Gainesville, Florida. She specializes in sediment capping as has been involved in RCRA and CERCLA remediation projects, including site investigation, remedy evaluation and selection, and remedial design and implementation. Before we go on to the next slide, Eric Blusky, have you been able to join the call? I'll follow up with Eric offline, but for now we'll continue on with the training. And I'm going to turn it over to John Cargill at the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. John?
Thank you, Juliana. As was said a few minutes ago, my name is John Cargill. I work for Delaware's Department of Natural Resources. And I have to say, first and foremost, it was a distinct honor to be one of the co-leaders of this incredible team of experts that's been put together that worked on this document and created this guidance and framework that we're going to introduce today. And on behalf of that entire team, I'd like to welcome all of you to this internet-based training event. Now, Juliana, if you could open up our first poll question, we are going to start with one. And this question really is trying to gauge the experience of our audience today. Not every audience is the same, and we can use this information to kind of change or deliver in the most appropriate way the information that we have today. So really we want to know from 1 to 5 how much knowledge and experience you have related to contaminated sediment sites. One being that you think you're an expert, and five, you don't have very much experience at all. While you guys are filling that out for a minute, I'll just quickly say that, we feel as a team that we've developed a relatively exciting training event today, or that you're going to experience today. And it's very inclusive of information and worksheets that we've put together to assist you as a user in escalating your efficiency and effectiveness of contaminated sediment site remediation projects. Now, it seems like most people have kind of finished, and we're seeing that we have folks with little or no knowledge and some folks with some knowledge, very few that think they're an expert. So really this points out to us that we're doing the right thing here, and we've got a good guidance document that we hope you enjoy today. So we're going to move on here to slide 7. And this is really just an introductory. I'm going to kind of introduce a few things to you guys today, and then I'm really going to turn it over to the experts that are going to give you the real good knowledge. But what I want you guys to see on the slide here is the numbers. Focus on the numbers. Now, we all know that fish advisories exist in nearly every state across the nation. And in the majority of cases, these fish advisories exist because of contaminants in fish tissue. And I'm talking about contaminants such as mercury, PCBs, dioxins, maybe chlorinated pesticides, the persistent bioaccumulative and toxic compounds. That tend to move up the food chain. And, these numbers are somewhat alarming, if you ask me. And really, it shouldn't be any surprise to folks when we say that contaminated sediments act as a source to contamination to the overlying surface water and the biota that live in that zone. So really, we're dealing with some sediment issues here, and this stuff moves up into higher trophic levels. So it's really a good thing that we're talking about sediment remediation. And the key word to associate here, and what I want really to point out here, is that we're dealing with bioaccumulation, and that's a process that's infinitely connected to bioavailability. That was a neat little trick there I did. I kind of set myself up to explain to you folks or introduce that we did, as a team, the ITRC team, produce another document. It was the first of our two documents that went online in 2011. And that document is all about incorporating bioavailability considerations into the assessment of contaminated sediment sites. We refer to it as CS1, or Contaminated Sediments 1, whereas this remediation document would be more referred to as CS2. But we do provide a link here on this page, and I encourage you to go look at that document as well. It certainly isn't a prerequisite to understanding or using the remediation document that we're going to talk about today, but it certainly does provide some good insight. It introduces the concept of bioavailability in many different ways, and is really just a good resource for you to know about and kind of have in your toolbox as we move forward. The other benefit that I can point out is a lot of our instructors today, as well as the team members that we had on the remediation team, were also on this bioavailability team. So we've really got a lot of the same folks that are kind of continuing on with this educational aspect and trying to help others do a better job at assessing contaminated sediments. So that was my primer for the other document. But let's get into the current document and what we're going to talk about today. And when we all got together initially, you know, we asked ourselves why should we develop a document on sediment remediation? And we answered our question in many times over. Now, sediment sites are definitely unique and oftentimes very complex. You've got the potential for multiple sources, multiple contaminants, differing habitats, differing waterway use. All of this stuff is potentially very challenging and can oftentimes really drive up the expense of a remediation project. And evaluating and selecting the optimal remedy to use at one of these sites can be extremely complicated, which again is a good reason to kind of put some things on paper and help folks through the process. Now, what we've done is produce a selection framework or a comparison framework that we felt were sort of absent from current sediment guidance documents that are out there today. And that's not to say that you know, the guidance documents that are out there by other agencies, you know, don't provide an abundance of good and useful information, but they typically don't provide a very comprehensive, you know, remedy selection framework. Or progressive comparison process. And what we've done is put that together, and we're going to provide that to you. The other thing we want to do is sort of advance the science, right? We want to move forward in the science of contaminated sediment remediation. So we want to help advance these existing technologies, present some new technologies maybe, and explain to folks the capabilities that we have with these technologies. And this often requires a multidisciplinary approach. So you may need some help with this from some of your colleagues. It's good to get other people involved, and we're going to explain all that. Lastly, you know, and as we look back at the survey results, I'll point out that there are a lot of folks out there that don't have the expertise in contaminated sediment management because of a lot of these complexities. So it really does indicate to us that the guidance we put together is useful and important. So I'm going to move on to slide 10. And try to answer the question, why would you use this guidance? The quickest and best answer I could give is, well, because we've pulled together, you know, most of the experts in the country and in some cases out of the country and sort of mined their brains, and we all got together and you know, checked all the agendas at the door and really had one focus, and that was providing a very good and detailed guidance document. We think we're providing tools that are going to assist in determining appropriate data needs, things necessary to collect when you're selecting a remedy. Again, we're going to point out advancements in old and new sediment remediation technologies, and this document covers the full gamut from monitor natural recovery and enhanced monitor natural recovery. We get into in-situ technologies, capping technologies, and both dredging and removal technologies. We think that we've created a platform for you all to get to the latest information, maybe not that's in our document, but links to other documents. It's very usable in a web format. You just have to kind of point, click, and go. We'll use that a few times, that term point, click, and go. And hopefully we'll show you how you can navigate some of what we've provided and make it easy. Now, we do provide a decision framework that, as I mentioned before, we feel is somewhat absent from other guidance documents. And we have developed a downloadable worksheet that can be used to record maybe decision points or record some of the data that you have as you go through this evaluation process. And it allows you to kind of retain that information or remember why you made the decisions you've made. One of the keys that we have worked on for a very long time when developing this document are what we call technology assessment guidelines, or TAGs. And these are sprinkled throughout the document and include guidance on how to most effectively use the information or different characteristics when evaluating a remedy or a contaminated sediment site. If you see a little flag that's on the screen that says tag on it, you'll know that there's a guideline that goes along with that. And as we get on with the presentation today, you're going to fully understand that more. So I'm not going to ruin that right now. You'll have to wait a little bit. Further, we're providing tools necessary to address, you know, applicability of remedial technologies at a site. You know, we're going to help you develop the right questions to ask yourself when you're evaluating alternatives after you've gone through some of this process, and not only evaluating the alternatives, but, you know, ultimately selecting a remedy for your site. And lastly, I'll point out that we include a lot of case studies in this document. I believe we have 88 different case studies summarized in the appendices. And that'll provide a resource for you guys to look at, maybe sites that are similar to yours in terms of the contaminant, maybe the habitat, maybe a few of the other characteristics that you have at your site. And we've got these broken down in different ways for you to go look at these case studies and see what kind of information might be out there, or maybe another person you could contact that has a little more expertise in that type of situation. Before we move on to the next slide, I do want to note that as a team, it's impossible for us to address all of the variability among local, state, and federal regulations. Things are different based upon where you are. And we have to throw the disclaimer out here that it's really up to you to contact those folks and find out if there are any, you know, state or regional specific items that you need to take into consideration when evaluating technologies. So I'm going to move on now to slide 11, and we're going to talk very briefly. I'm going to introduce this framework that I mentioned, the Sediment Remedy Evaluation Framework. Now, we've created a six-step framework for evaluating all sediment remediation technologies, really based on site-specific data. And this diagram that's on this slide, don't worry if you can't read the text in the little blue boxes, but you're going to see that throughout the talk today, and it's just going to kind of show you where you are in the process. And this framework, really, again, you don't need to read the steps. I'll point them out, but really step one is identifying your site characteristics first and foremost, and then we go into a second step, which is zone mapping and development, which leads into an initial screening of remedial technologies. Once you've gotten through the initial screen, we'll explain our detailed technology evaluation step, and this is where we get into some of the technology assessment guidelines and maybe some of the data needs to evaluate different technologies. That'll come within that step, which is then followed by developing alternatives, and lastly, evaluating those alternatives to ultimately choose one or two of the best technologies that you might use at your site. I'm going to say this one more time, too, that another really advanced feature that we have in this electronic guidance is the capability to point, click, and go to whatever section of the guidance you want. So when you're on the website and you see this flow chart here, you can click on any of the boxes, and it's going to take you directly to that step. You don't have to scroll through page after page after page trying to find where you need to be. You just click on that box, and you go right there. So moving on here, we're on slide 12. I want to talk about the advantages of a web document. Now, Juliana pointed out, and I'm going to point out again, that this is a web-based document. It's not a paper document, you know, with a front and back cover. I think you could certainly print out a PDF from our website to have the information, but you're going to lose all that function that we've built into this. We feel we've got a pretty user-friendly, online, comprehensive resource. We'll call it a one-stop shop, if you will, that drives you, the user, to information throughout the whole framework process. It might be to another guidance document somewhere else. It might be to another part of our own document. But we're going to help drive you to just where you need to be quickly and easily and make it a little easy for you to use on the web. So, again, I point out here we have these technology overviews. that we include. So we're going to talk about each type of technology that I mentioned, MNR, EMNR, capping in situ, and dredging technologies, with as up-to-date information as we can, again, driven by site-specific data, and through the use of our tags that are really going to help you hone in on what that technology is, its benefits, how to evaluate it, and to decide whether it's good to use potentially at your property or your site. Again, we also have this selection framework that I just went over in the last slide, that's really going to help enhance your selection process and utilize the site-specific information that you've got to make the best decision. One of the worksheets that we've got here attached to this web-based document, it's downloadable, and you can have that on your desktop as you go through your evaluation. Again, taking notes, maybe filling in some of these cells that are going to document your decision points and really help to lay it all out in one big worksheet, if you will, so you can look at things holistically. And we'll get into the details of that in a little while. We do believe that we've provided information that's driven by site-specific data, and that was very important to the team, and we had a lot of discussions about that. There are a lot of generalizations that can be made. You can skip steps along the way, and that may or may not be a benefit to you. What was very important to us is that we're pointing you, the user, to what's necessary to evaluate these technologies based on just the data you've collected at your site. Our technology assessment guidelines are one of the keys for helping do that. excuse me, let me take a quick sip of water. Again, here on the web document or this web-based document, we do provide information to help you develop and evaluate an alternative based on these site-specific characteristics. And we will get into some combination remedies, too. This is not a brand new idea, but a relatively new idea of using, you know, multiple technologies at a single site to achieve the goals that you have. And lastly, you know, we offer in some of our evaluation steps, it's some advanced evaluation beyond the typical 9 NCP criteria. And later on in the presentation, we'll get into those specifically. Now, some of the advantages of today's training, you know, the whole reason that you got on this call today is really to understand what we have available in this document to use. So we'll provide a complete and pretty thorough overview of the content and the functionality of this remediation document. We'll provide you a couple of examples on how to most effectively use the decision framework that we've introduced. And lastly, we'll provide you with an opportunity to ask questions of us right now during this presentation using the question pod that Juliana pointed out earlier. And I recommend that you guys use that. If you've got questions about what we're talking about, feel free to ask. We want to share this information as much as you want to get the information. So don't hesitate. Now, what do we think you can do after this training? Three key words here. We think you're going to be able to identify, evaluate, and apply. We want you to be able to identify site characteristics that are necessary or important to evaluating different technologies and identify what data needs you have or are lacking so you can go get them in order to effectively evaluate an alternative. Obviously, evaluate here. We want you to be able to choose the most favorable technology for use at your site based on the site-specific data you have or the criteria that you've set based upon your site. And we want to get you down to, you know, applying just what's going to be best and maybe screening out what's not going to work early in the process. So you don't waste a lot of resources on these evaluations. And lastly, again, you're going to be able to apply your expert know-how, and the more you use this framework and the more you use, you know, the information that we're providing, we think the more advanced your skills will become and, you know, the better projects you'll have. So I'm almost done talking here, but I have two more slides. It is important that I point out that in going into a large guidance document like this, we have to put bounds on it so it doesn't get too unruly or too big. So we had to go into this and establish some assumptions. And here's what those assumptions are. That the nature and extent of your contaminants of concern have been characterized sufficiently, and that you've got a conceptual site model to support that. We assume that you have a completed human health and ecological risk assessment, and you've confirmed that there are risks at your site and that they're unacceptable. So we've definitely got a problem to fix. We assume that other environmental endpoints, in this case we're referring to your receptors, that you want to protect have been identified. We are assuming that loading from controlled releases or uncontrolled releases have been characterized, maybe taken care of, or at least you know that they're there and you've determined that it's okay that they're there. And lastly, that you have remedial action objectives or RAOs established with your stakeholder input. I'll talk to you later about some stakeholder considerations where contaminated sediment sites are concerned, but it's important that you talk to them early, and we feel that by the time you're evaluating a remedy, you should have talked to them already. So the last thing I'm going to do is introduce an example site to you. Now, I think three of our presenters today are going to build upon this example site during the presentation, so it's important to at least introduce you guys to it right now. We have sort of created a hypothetical urban waterway here. You can see on the slide there that it's an industrial site. Our contaminants of concern are our PCBs, lead, and chlordane. You can see that there are some characteristics or features that are unique to this site, including bulkheads, soft sediments. There are some habitat areas that are of concern, and that we've got some debris and some infrastructure that may pose some challenges as we move through our evaluation. But with this example, what we're going to do is kind of go through some of the steps on how to apply the process as we move along, including establishing zones, which was one of the steps in the process. We're going to, give you an overview of some of the data that's important for assessing remedial technologies at our hypothetical site, how to access some of the current information about remediation technologies that we have in the document, and through the use of this, we hope you gain a better understanding of how some of the site-specific characteristics that really drive the selection of a remedial technology at a sediment site, and maybe how you can combine different technologies into one comprehensive remedy. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Steve Clough, a risk assessor with Haley and Aldrich. And he's going to start diving a little deeper into the details of the first few steps here. Steve, take it away.
Thank you, John. Can you hear me? I just want to make sure I'm not on mute here.
I can hear you.
Okay, great. So my name's Steve Clough. I'm an ecological risk assessor. And let's start off the training outline. The three sections I'm going to talk about will be a review of the site characteristics. Step two will be remedial zone identification and mapping. And step three is screening of remedial technology. I'm going to just break the ice on that a little bit. And the rest of the presenters will present the evaluation of remedial technology and remedial action alternatives and a little bit on monitoring and stakeholder concerns. So slide number 18 is step one, which is a review of the site characteristics. Just on a personal note here, in the last 4 years I've been working at the Hastings on the Hudson site in the Hudson River on the baseline sampling and analysis plan, and a lot of what I have done fits perfectly in with the three steps I'm going to be reviewing. We looked at surface water, sediment, pole water, fish, and habitat. So some of the slides and pictures I'll be reviewing back for that baseline sampling and analysis plan. So you often require, as John said, we assume the RI is complete. You've got your RAOs for the different media. You're familiar with the risk assessment process. But we designed this document to go from the least invasive to the most invasive. So the least invasive might be MNR, and it's the least expensive. And then The most invasive would be dredging. So we're kind of leading you through this document from a least labor-intensive to most labor-intensive. And each site will have maybe a combination of one or two or even three of those alternatives. But you'll often require additional data. You will certainly, most of the time, 9 out of 10 times, need a supplemental RI. Certainly pre-design investigations to support the conceptual site model. You know the conceptual site model involves a source, identification of the source, the pathways, the receptor, the time frame, and the fate and transport of the compound. And so step one, we've got four different genres. We've got the physical, which might include bathymetry or debris fields in the site, characteristics of the sediment, the benthic community, scour zones, depositional zones, background data that you may have gotten from the state or from NOAA, the contaminant, what's the nature and extent of the contaminant, the horizontal and vertical distribution, and you may get into congener forensics. And then the land and waterway use, get into a little bit of that. A basic rule of thumb, all four of these, of course, are not mutual exclusive, they'll overlap. But my basic rule of thumb is every time you check a box or dip your toe in the water, you're going to come up with more questions and surprises that you did not anticipate, and you should certainly have budgeted for that. The next slide, the first part of the site review will be the physical nature of the site. That will include infrastructure, which is probably your biggest unknown, something like, well, let me back up here. Infrastructure, you're probably, one reason for failure at a site typically will be a pier or something that you can't get to actually remediate. At this picture on the right, we have the Hastings on Hudson site. We have a bunch of pilings there. Those will have to be removed. And I've talked to other dredgers. They run into debris fields, so your bathymetry is going to be key. This is your underwater topo map. It's definitely one of your first pieces of information you want to get at the site, and it's a critical piece of information, and it will help you identify debris fields, and you may have dams that may pose a problem. Hydrodynamics is critical. And that's a good segue from bathymetry, because bathymetry will affect your hydrodynamics. You're going to have scour and channel sinuosity. You're going to have high energy and low energy zones within your site. If you're on an estuary, you'll have tides and with some pretty high energy eddies in the Hudson River here. Slope stability is important. Is strongly affected again by hydrodynamics and the type of sediment at your site. Dredging in the littoral zone might affect, for example, the bulkheads. It may undermine a bulkhead. So if you're an engineer, you certainly are aware of this type of problem. Groundwater, surface water interaction is critical. You want to make sure that your upland site, that all the sources are controlled. So you don't want to end up cleaning up your sediment and then 5 years later it's contaminated again from migration of PCBs or volatiles or whatever from the upgradient site. And then finally, habitat. Eelgrass in the Hudson is a very sensitive, sacred type of biota, and they really don't want to dig up eelgrass beds just to remove small amounts of contamination. So these are the physical aspects of a site that you need to consider. The characteristics of sediment are critical. The geotechnical, what is your grain size distribution? If you have a lot of fines, you're going to have apparently high concentrations of metals, for example, because the higher your surface area, the higher concentrations of metals. And you may have silt or clay, a filter clay combination, and that may dovetail in with sediment consolidation, which is important to your cap design. So if you put down a cap is your sediment bed going to be able to support that cap? Potential for resuspension. You can take cores and take them into a lab and do what's called sed flume testing. I'm not an engineer, but basically they expose the cores to different hydrodynamic conditions and determine the potential for mobilization of the sediment. And finally, benthic community. Over here on the right, there's a picture of a sediment profile image. This is about 18 centimeters high, and you can see there's an anoxic zone with a lot of iron sulfides, and then you have an oxidized zone where you don't have the sulfides. They'd probably be more in the sulfates, and then you have the benthic community will typically inhabit the top 0 to 6 centimeters. So, for example, John mentioned bioavailability. If we had metals, these sulfides would bind to metals and render them non-bioavailable, so you'd have to perform an ABS-SEM type of analysis. And then the benthic community structure, this supports all the upper trophic level fish and wildlife. So when we did sediment profile image in the Hudson, we also took co-located grabs for benthic macroinvertebrates. We sent that off to a taxonomy lab where they calculated abundance and diversity and different indices, what's pollution sensitive, what's pollution tolerant organisms, things such as that. Another characteristic is the characteristics of the contaminants. I'm always harping on this. I can't tell you how many sites I've been to where they've taken one background sample, which does nothing for you. So the ideal situation would be, say, you're on a river, you have an upstream, an adjacent, and a downstream type of situation. My rule of thumb is typically try to sample as many upstream samples as you have adjacent or downstream, maybe a 3-4-3 type of situation. We've got 3 upstream, 4 adjacent, and 3 downstream. But you really need to have a good frame of reference. If you're in an estuary situation, remember downstream is going to come onto your site as well as upstream. Upstream influences, have you identified stormwater culverts, which may have non-point solution? Do you have CSOs? Do you have non-point pollution from agricultural runoff? What is the contaminant type? John mentioned that typically we have PBTs, which are persistent, bioavailable, or toxic compounds. But there are some situations you may have where, for example, you may have a site with phenols that biodegrade over time. So you've got to look at the contaminant type and the nature and extent. Ebullition is very important at like MGP sites where you'll have gas production, and these little gas bubbles will bleb up and create sheen. So you've got to consider, do you have a propensity for ebullition at your site? The distribution of the compound, what is the nature and extent? Not only horizontally, but you've got to determine vertically, and typically, just as a rule of thumb, we usually go down to about 3 feet to make sure that we've gone down into a material of a refusal or whatever, just so the site is completely covered. John mentioned bioavailability. This is key. Whatever is not bioavailable, you may have high concentrations, but if it's not bioavailable, you have no risk. So go to the bioavailability considerations document, which covers exposure, bioaccumulation, and biomagnification. A very, very rich document, rich in detail and information. Slide number 22, characteristics of the site as far as land and waterway. What is the current and anticipated use? For example, on the upland side, what is the future use of the site? Is it going to be commercial? Is it going to be industrial? Are you going to have residential condos? Will it be a walkway? Maybe there might even be swimming. Who knows? And then the waterway, will it be, for example, a marina? Will it be recreation? Will it be barge traffic? Things like that. Site access is critical. At the Hastings site, we have a train station, very narrow roads coming down. How will the regular passage of cars and dump trucks affect the community during the remedial process? Watershed characteristics. Are your flood zones defined? As I mentioned earlier, have you looked at CSOs and stormwater upstream? In the winter, will there be ice floes? If you have a cap and you have ice floes, that's going to take the cap out. That's not going to be a very good situation. Sensitive and habitat species. Have you documented, have you got all the state and federal records and documented threatened, sensitive, or endangered species? And again, I've told you, you don't want to rip up a vegetated wetland just because it has low levels of contamination. And most regulators I've talked to will give you a pass on this and say, look, this is a natural wetland. We realize it's irreplaceable if we dig it up. Cultural and archaeological resources. These aren't covered too often, but this genre should be addressed, and I think it should be considered in the due diligence step if you've got a historical site. So step two is your remedial zone identification and mapping. So a good example or analogy is I have a huge yard. I've got a lot of leaves in the fall. So I'm going to look at this yard, and I'm going to divide and conquer is my MO. I'm going to say, okay, I can get some leaves up with mowing. That's fairly low energy, and then I can get some of them up in this section with my leaf blower, but then in this section, which has a lot of leaves, I'm going to have to get out the rake and the kids and do a lot of work. So it's the same with a sediment site. You're going to have some areas that might be MNR with a low amount of labor and funds, and you're going to have some areas that you may have to dredge. But all of this is going to help to support the development of your multiple remedial alternatives if there are multiple ones at your site. You're going to identify the zones based on site-specific characteristics, and the example we give here is low energy deposition versus high energy erosion. In the lower graphic, I think most of you know, with a channel sinuosity in a river, you're going to have deposition on the convex part of the river, but you're going to have erosion on the concave side. So these are things that you just have to keep in mind when you're looking at your site. What is the approach in slide 24 for zone identification? Well, the easiest approach is to start with identification of contaminant distribution, look at sediment quality values, evaluate other distinguishing characteristics. Have you done toxicity tests? Or if you've done a set of sediment quality triad, you're in good shape. Look at maybe congener forensics, what part of your site is contaminated with, say, Aeroplore 1254, but you know that at your site they didn't use that particular Aeroplore or something like that. So the number of zones will always be site-specific, and it can be very simple to highly complex depending on the lines of evidence. And in the graphic below here, you see on the convex side we have a depositional zone, but we also have a groundwater flux zone. So that's just an example of what might be happening at your site. This is an example of a site that we worked on in San Francisco Bay. It's a former MGP site. The bathymetry was fairly flat, so we laid out a simple grid. And basically the green columns on the right-hand side represented ambient conditions. We divided these up into cells, and within each cell we would take a few composite samples and basically did a sediment quality triad with a few other bells and whistles, like we used caged mussels. We actually looked at body burden in some of the worms. We looked at pore water, benthic toxicity. And then we divided it up into different colors on these pentagons and tried to determine what was the best remedial alternative. So the middle column was pretty much MNR, and the column on the left was some removal and capping. So it's this type of multiple lines of evidence that can really help you with the physical and the biological and the chemical type of analysis. Slide 26, this is getting into our example site that John was talking about, a site in New Jersey, and the first step was to put the different concentrations in bins and color code these bins based on sediment quality values. Now, sediment quality values, as I've said in the bioavailability document, you'd never rely on those for cleanup. These are just shedding light to give you some indication of the degree of contamination. And I always run a Pearson's correlation matrix, especially with metals, to try to see what's going on between the different contaminants, because you're going to have a lot of correlation between metals and, say, organics in some situations. For example, here you can see in all three graphics, PCBs, lead, and chlordane coexist. But we're going to focus on the lower oval, which we're going to call zone 3, and drill down a little bit and get more into something besides contamination or levels of contamination. For example, in the upper area, we have a bulkhead area. In the middle area, we have very soft sediments, but it's good for habitat, for benthic habitat. Maybe they saw a lot of benthic organisms in this area that were sensitive. And then down in the lower portion, there's a lot of debris, but it's also a depositional area. So this is an example of things you need to think about. So step 3 is getting into the screening of remedial technologies, and this is where it can be very helpful to you, especially if you're a novice, because what the web-based document has a spreadsheet built into it, and table 2-3 in this document can be downloaded, and it contains questions pertaining to each remedial technology. And you will answer each one of these questions and fill in the cells with specific data that will help you to evaluate remedial technologies and alternatives and to determine their applicability. And the exercise will definitely help you, or may help you, hopefully help you, eliminate one or more technologies from further consideration. So here's an example in Table 2-3 of monitored natural recovery. So, for example, in one of the middle cells, it says net sediment deposition rates are adequate to consider natural sedimentation as a reasonable alternative to meet RAOs. And the user clicked yes, and then put in the rate, click the radio button of medium, and put in a note, site is classified as depositional on state maps, but the rate of deposition is not yet known. And then down the bottom in the green, it says, based on these conditions, should MNR be retained for further consideration, yes or no? And that yes or no will kind of sum up what you've done in the above cells. And then you'll also enter a comment, any comment that you feel it is applicable to the site that will help your clients. This is an example in the table of the rows for enhanced monitored natural recovery. And that may include, capping with amendments such as carbon or sedimite or something like that, a thin layer capping, I meant to say. So the third cell down, it says characteristics of the site do not inhibit or prevent placement of enhancement materials. And the user clicked yes, confidence is medium because it's applicable to zone 3, medium score since located in an urban setting. So again, you move forward and you fill out these radio buttons and your different cells, and then you'll move into the screening worksheet, this is the end of table 2-3, which is the grand finale, which will help you address in situ treatment, conventional capping, amended capping, dry excavation, and wet excavation. So you're going from least invasive to most invasive. So you click the final cell and it will generate your remedial technology evaluation worksheet. And that moves us on to the next section of our presentation for this document, which will be presented by Paul Duty. He's a very competent and experienced remedial engineer with Anchor QEA, and you can take it away, Paul.
Well, thank you, Steve. Assuming everyone can hear me.
Somebody can.
Confirm? Oh,
yes.
Thank you. All right, so as Steve had mentioned, I'm going to continue on here and cover step 4, which is the evaluation of remedial technologies, and I'll show you a kind of a continuation of the worksheet that Steve started in the screening step. So maybe before we begin, Juliana, if we could do a quick survey to understand maybe what folks' understanding is of the various technologies available for sediment cleanup. So if you guys could kind of click on which technologies you've utilized before, and we can just get a sense for the perspective and experience with the folks we have on the phone. So Well, interestingly, I see a pretty high percentage with M&R experience and a pretty decent decent spread. So this is good. We've got a wide range of experience. As I go through this, it's not meant to provide a full education of the different technologies, but I will be given a very broad brush overview of the different technologies and be able to show you where in the guidance document additional, more detailed information is available, and it's a real helpful resource for folks, whether you're experienced in that arena or not. So maybe we'll move on from here, but appreciate everyone's participation there. And, well, we talked about the different technologies. So the next aspect of this is just step four. What does it include? If we go back to that flow chart, essentially is a more detailed evaluation of the remaining technologies or those technologies that remain after the screening step that Steve explained. And I'll go through a pretty detailed explanation of the tools that we have in the guidance to help you go through that and document your work. The guidance itself has a pretty detailed section on each technology, and the real purpose of this step is to help determine what you think is the most favorable technology, which then would be combined and pulled together into an overall alternative that can be evaluated in the next step. So really, it's the purpose here is to determine what you think is most favorable. It doesn't imply that the other technology is favorable. And earlier we talked a little bit about these technology assessment guidelines, and this is the section of the guidance where we really get into the meat of that. So the four basic technologies that were listed there, we've got M&R and EM&R, and that's there's a detailed section in Section 3. Of the guidance that provides the information there. In situ treatment is Section 4, capping Section 5, removal in Section 6. And within each of these sections, we've got a description of the technology or technologies. We've also got kind of recent developments, things that have been happening at least up to the time that the guidance was developed. And I would encourage folks to do more research to make sure that you've got a current understanding, because in this field, things do develop fairly quickly. So check the date of the guidance and make sure that you're current. Each section also has a description of each of the characteristics that Steve walked through, the site characteristics. And in many cases, we've got technology assessment guidelines established and described in each technology section. And John had mentioned the 80-plus case studies that we've got in the guidance document. So maybe just a brief overview of each of the technologies. M&R really is akin to the monitored natural attenuation that you might be familiar with upland sites. But the purpose here is to rely on natural processes to reduce the exposure to the contaminants that you have through processes like burial. That panel on the right gives you an illustration of kind of the burial and mixing process, where you've got suspended sediment in the water column that deposits in, and you've got natural deposition over what may be historic contaminated sediment. Enhanced monitored natural recovery uses a little bit of human intervention to apply some other technology to help enhance or accelerate the natural recovery processes. And a couple of technologies that are out there in the EM&R category are thin layer cap, where you could place a very thin layer of clean sediment on top of the contaminated sediment to accelerate that burial process. Or you might add some amendment to help sequester or treat the contaminated sediment. And the panel on the right there is an illustration, again, a sediment profile image similar to one Steve had shown earlier. And what's shown here is you can see the black activated carbon that had been added and sprinkled on top of the sediments, and you can see the benthic organisms have started to work that carbon into the underlying sediment. So just another way to kind of accelerate the sequestration of some organic contaminants using activated carbon. The next technology is in situ treatment, and this is one of those developing fields for contaminated sediment. I've probably seen it used quite a bit upland, but it's a very quickly evolving field. So this is one in particular where I'd encourage you to do some additional research to make sure you're current on where things stand with different treatment approaches. But kind of your standard suite of whether you've got a physical, biological, or chemical treatment approach. But the concept is that you're going to take some amendment, add it, and mix it into the sediments in order to facilitate some form of treatment. And you may use a combination of methods. Some kind of keys to success are obviously picking the right amendment to serve the purpose of the treatment that you're trying to facilitate. How are you going to apply or deliver that amendment to the sediments? The panel on the right gives you a picture of a technology that's been employed with sediments to apply solidification stabilization amendments, but could really apply to any amendment where you've got a caisson that's driven through the water column and into the sediments, and then an auger device that's used to inject the amendment and then mix it with the sediments. So that's just one technology. There are others that are out there and described in the guidance. Really important to understand the limitations, and if you need really good mixing, how good a mixing can you get, and what are some of the potential issues with mixing the amendments into the sediment. A couple of technologies that are more developed than others are activated carbon, and also solidification stabilization is actually one of the remedies that was required as part of the Gowanus Canal Record of Decision, and there's also an EPRI study that's out there where they evaluated and studied this technology at the Connecticut River in Connecticut. Okay, capping. A lot of folks were familiar with capping, but the idea with capping is placement of clean material over the sediment. Not so much like enhanced monitored natural recovery where you're just trying to provide a acceleration of the natural process, but here you may be trying to engineer the stabilization of the material or the contaminated sediment so it doesn't erode. You may be looking at trying to isolate the contamination in the sediment to keep it from being transported into the overlying water column and available for exposure to the biological community. And you may also just be looking to physically separate that contaminated sediment from the benthic community from being exposed. And typical materials are like a clean sand or something of that nature. You may actually add some amendments to that material to enhance the adsorptability or even to facilitate some treatment through that active layer. And if you've got a layer down there that you want to keep there, you may need to armor it to protect the cap. You can see in the actually the top panel is use of a clamshell to place the cap material. You can see the clamshell sprinkling some of the material, and then the bottom panel is a marine armor mattress. It's an engineered device that you could use to armor that cap layer. The other thing to think about is if you're selecting materials to use in your cap, how that might impact the habitat. It could be a positive or could be a negative, but consider that in your selection process. You may be able to pick something that actually has a positive impact on the habitat. And the last technology is the most commonly deployed or employed technology of removal. I think most folks are familiar with this. where you could be looking at a dredging process where you're removing the sediments through the water column. That photo is a mechanical clamshell dredge where you pull the sediments out of the environment through dredging. You may also have, there's also hydraulic options as well. The other approach is to excavate the sediment, where maybe you have the opportunity to bypass flow in a creek or isolate a section of the contaminated sediment area, dewater the area, and then remove the material in a more traditional excavation sense. Once you remove the material, you also need to consider the support processes, because typically you're going to remove it, you need to do something with it. So you need to look at where this material is going to go, whether you're going to dispose of it in a landfill, whether you're going to dispose of it on site. Maybe there's an opportunity to beneficially use this material, depending on the contamination, and maybe if you want to look at treatment before that as well. So based on how you want to get rid of the material, you need to also consider how you're going to transport it. Do you need to dewater or condition that material? So a lot of things go along with the dredging excavation of contaminated sediments. And finally, I'll point out the guidance also talks about what's referred to as the four R's. Anytime you're dredging material, you're going to have some resuspension of those contaminated sediments. It's just not practical to remove all the sediments, so you're going to be faced with having some residual contamination that you're going to need to manage. And those materials that are resuspended or residual can act as a source of contaminant release to the water body and associated risk thereof. So there's a lot of other guidance out there that the Corps has, and our guidance gives a primer, but then refers you and provides links to the other guidance. Okay, so that's an overview of the different technologies. John had mentioned earlier about these technology assessment guidelines, a very unique feature of this guidance document that we were all pretty pleased to be able to incorporate. And the idea here is the various site characteristics that Steve had introduced that you need to understand at your site was to each section of the guidance here for each technology describes each of those characteristics. And where we could, we tried to put in some quantitative or qualitative guidelines that the users could look at and basically compare that and put it in context with the site-specific information they have to provide an assessment of how favorable this technology might be at the specific site. And these tags were meant to be based on either simplified models, relationships, and in large part were the experience of the wealth of experience that we had around the table in developing this guidance. But one thing we really want to point out is the intent isn't to create these pass-fail criteria to be used on any individual basis, but really to look at the weight of evidence of all of the characteristics that you have and how your site weighs up to that to help assess the applicability or the favorability of any individual technology. Okay, so we have a table in the guidance. It's table 2.4. And this really is a central navigating tool and really highlights the advantages of the web-based document that we created. And so what's shown here, this is just a piece of that table, and I'm going to give a little bit of an overview and then show you how the navigation works within the table. But if you see on the top row, we have the various technologies that I talked about with from MNR through removal. And then for each characteristic, we have a cell that's populated with some information. And so what you see the information in here is if you see that little flag with the tag, that means there's a technology assessment guideline for that particular characteristic and that technology. The numbers that are in there designate the section of the guidance where that's described, And the designation of H, M, or L is really a relative importance of that characteristic for that given technology. So an H means it's a high importance or a critical factor. M is moderate or it's a contributing factor, and low means it's, or L means it's low or relatively unimportant. So maybe to show a little bit of the navigation here, and again, this is just showing you six different characteristics. We've got all 34 characteristics listed in the table in the guidance. So if we wanted to understand sediment deposition rate for MNR, that cell again is there is a tag. It's a critical factor, and section 3.4.1.2 is the section where that's described. But rather than making you scroll down to get it, if you click on that cell, boom, it takes you to the guidance section 3.4.1.2. And what you can see here is for each of these characteristics and for this deposition rate and NMNR, we've got a couple of paragraphs of text that give you a sense for how sediment deposition rate is, why it's important to MNR. And if you see blue text next to the tag signal, or tag symbol, I should say, you see some text that is the actual technology assessment guideline. And in this case, if you see at the bottom of that text, quantitative guideline here that says that sites with annual net deposition rates greater than roughly 0.5 centimeters per year are prime candidates for MNR, EMNR. So that's a case where we've got a quantitative guideline. Now, if we wanted to look at presence of hard bottom and look at that relative to hydraulic dredging, again, that's a critical factor. There is a tag for it in section 6.6.6. We click on it, takes us there. And here you see a little bit different in that we've got the tag shown in three different locations embedded within the textual description of why the presence of hard bottom is important to hydraulic dredging. And in this case, these are really more qualitative guidelines. And, something like that contaminated sediment that's lodged in crevices and bedrock can be impractical to remove, things like that. So the idea here is that the user looks at this information, and what we've provided is another table, table 2.5, and this is part of the worksheet that Steve introduced. And I don't mean for you to read all the text that's in here. I'll talk a little bit more in detail about how we intended this to be used by users. But the real purpose here was to provide a tool for users to be able to document this evaluation process. And what you'll see is that this is a pretty thorough process, and we really want folks to spend the time to go through all of the different characteristics for each of the different technologies that remain after that screening step. And if you may remember from Steve earlier, one of the things that when he hit generate the worksheet, dry removal had been screened out for this site. And again, I'm using zone 3 that Steve had introduced. And dry removal was screened out, so that doesn't show up on the worksheet. So once you generate this, the idea is to fill in the blanks. And the blank information that will be on the spreadsheet is the column of site-specific information and then all of the text that the user would enter in for each of the technologies. So if we've got 34 characteristics and here you've got seven technologies, that's a lot of information to get through. So you really want to spend the time. Probably will take you, on the order of 40 to 80 hours to get through that. But it's worth it when you're trying to evaluate these contaminated sediment sites. They can have big liabilities, and I think the investment in that time is well worth it. So maybe to give you a sense for the types of information that one might enter in here, and again, there's no right or wrong answer to this. This is really meant to be a way for you to document the process that you went through. And maybe one way to think about it is if 5 years from now you wanted to go back to understand why you picked one technology over another to be more favorable, this documentation could be used to help remind yourself of how you got there. So as an example, sediment deposition rate under MNR for your site, you felt that net deposition rate was positive for MNR. That may be what you indicate in here. If you actually had some numeric information, you may decide to enter that in. Another example would be, so presence of debris relative to hydraulic dredging. Based on the site-specific information that you have, you may have determined that this could be a significant problem for hydraulic dredge and could increase resuspension. So those are the things that you would walk through and input into the spreadsheet. And then once you get through each of the individual categories, so in this case, this was the physical characteristics, you have a way to take all of those characteristics and as I'd mentioned before, use a weight of evidence evaluation to determine the favorability of the different technologies. And what you do is you click on whether you thought in the left-hand case, MNR, whether that was favorable, moderately favorable, or unfavorable. And you basically click on that button. And this one we felt was favorable in zone 3. And what happens, it populates the notes cell in a green color, green being favorable. If you selected moderately favorable, it would have been yellow. And you'll see on the right-hand side that for hydraulic dredging, felt it was unfavorable due to the significant amount of debris. If you remember zone 3, Steve had mentioned there was a lot of debris in the south end and we had bulkheads in the northern end. So that was assessed as being unfavorable. So once you go through this for all of the different characteristics, similar to the worksheet and as Steve had introduced, you get to the bottom and then you generate a report, you click on that, and a summary report comes up. And you see the color coding for each of the different technologies and the four different characteristic categories. The other thing I wanted to mention was this notes column that's color-coded. You can enter in summary text for your assessment as to its favorability. So you create this nice summary table that you can use in the next step of the process, which is to take this evaluation and then turn things into a remedial alternative that 'll be evaluated. And what I'm going to do is turn it over to Eric Blischke of CDM Smith, who's going to take you through the next step. And Eric's a senior environmental scientist who's got over 25 years experience. And as I'd mentioned, he's with CDM Smith. But maybe before we get to that, I think we were going to take a quick break and open it up to Q&A.
Thanks, Paul. We are going to have time for questions, so feel free to send in your questions using that Q&A box in the lower right. If you're in the phone line audience, you can jump in with a question out loud. Before we start asking those questions, let's get Eric just to double check that you're able to unmute the phone and check in.
Yeah, I think I'm unmuted. Can you
hear me? Perfect. We do hear you. Thank you.
Fantastic.
We are going to ask a few questions before we go on to the next section. A couple have come in. One question. We're concerned about recontamination after the remedy is implemented and are doing our best to characterize the ongoing potential sources. Do our trainers have experience with this type of occurrence?
Yeah, and I think this is Paul here. I think we have a section of the guidance, and I think John introduced this here, but the importance of source control is is critical to the effectiveness of any remedy that you're going to implement. And this guidance didn't get into the details of source control, but we do have a discussion about how important that is. And the assumption for this guidance is that you have a handle on those sources and have a plan to deal with those sources. But I think we all would agree that managing and controlling sources is critical to the effectiveness of any technology that's implemented.
As I mentioned in my talk, I haven't worked at the site, but like the United Hackathon site, they did a lot of dredging there to remove DDT, and they eventually came to the conclusion that they didn't get under the piers where they should have gotten, which is very difficult to do anyway, and they think a lot of the residual came from areas that they just could not dredge. So it's important to look at just about everything before you move forward with your remedial alternative.
How do you deal with long-term effectiveness requirement when you're considering ARARs for capping engineering controls?
Well, I think that, Paul here again, I think long-term effectiveness is always a concern with any technology where you're leaving some contamination behind. Typically with capping remedies, you have monitoring and maintenance requirements over time to routinely go out and make sure your cap is still intact, and if not, that repairs are made. There may also be institutional controls that are implemented with caps, things like restrictions in anchoring or modifications to dredging in those areas so you don't disturb the cap, things of that nature. And I think you can build all that into your evaluation.
And moving back a few steps, this is where your baseline sampling plan comes in also. You want to have a baseline before you even stick a spade in the sediment, so to speak. So you want to know what the concentrations are in the sediment, the fish, the pore water, the surface water. And then so you have a baseline frame of reference. So when everything's said and done and you've done your cleanup, you can monitor and you know whether you're improving on what the baseline was.
Yeah, Steve, you also reminded me of another. But there are a number of tools that are available to be able to also estimate the effectiveness of a cap. So modeling of transport through a cap, modeling of contaminants through a cap, things of that nature. So you're able to develop some estimate of how effective the cap would be. And a number of these have been, you know, validated through experimental data. So pretty right. good set of resources to be able to model that.
And yeah, Paul, cases, and this is Avna. I would agree with Paul here. So even for cap, with the design itself, we start with the modeling to predict some kind of cap lifetime, and it does go with the monitoring plan. So it can be only based on physical conditions where we can monitor the physical integrity of the cap over time, or it can also include chemical performance. But that is the approved plan based on how regulators and project team approves and proceeds with that. We will discuss some of the baseline and construction and post-remediation monitoring shortly in the monitoring section slides too.
Yeah, and this is Eric. And in some cases, you may have to use, you know, reactive materials such as activated carbon, you know, within your cap, you know, as part of your cap design to actually meet some of those criteria if you're monitoring at the surface of the cap or pore water, you know, near the surface of the cap.
Thank you, and thanks to all of our trainers. We'll go ahead and wrap this question and answer break up. If you do have questions throughout the second half, please go ahead and send those in. In some cases, we'll reply back to you in that Q&A pod, so you're welcome to look for a response back. If you do leave before we wrap up today, remember to fill out that feedback form. It's in those related URLs. It's the last one listed. So you select the name and then you select browse to. That's going to open that feedback form. We do really appreciate you giving us feedback, and we use the information that you provide. It's also an opportunity for you to create a certificate of participation. So be sure to complete the feedback, check the box at the bottom, and that is going to allow the system to create a certificate for you. For now, we'll continue on with the next section of the training, and I'm going to turn it over to Eric Blesky at CDM Smith. Eric?
Okay. Thank you. And I guess I have control so I can advance, right? Okay. There we go. So, again, my name is Eric Blesky. I'm with CDM Smith, and I'm going to talk about a couple of the steps here, steps 5 and 6 of the guidance, which is development of remedial action alternatives and then the evaluation of those alternatives. And I think Steve and Paul did a great job, actually, talking about, you know, kind of the site-specific factors that you would consider, you know, the site characteristics that you would consider in terms of evaluating various technologies and how those characteristics can influence, you know, the effectiveness of that technology, the implementability of that technology, and as Paul mentioned, you know, which technologies are, you know, most favorable. And so, I mean, I think that's really fundamental, I think, to the whole guidance, really, is the idea that, you know, you can use this site-specific information to help you identify the technologies that are going to, you know, work best at your site, and that you're going to use that information to help, you know, develop your remedial action alternatives. And we've come up with the concept, I guess, to, put a finer point on this or make it a little more systematic is the idea of these remedial zones. So, you know, you're going to initially go in there and, you know, identify that based on contamination and then kind of refine those as you go forward. So maybe just to review a little bit, we talked about the identification of zones, and the initial zone identification is based on contaminant distribution. So you're going to go look at, you know, you go out and characterize your site, nature and extent of contamination, and really identify the areas that, you know, pose the greatest risk or exceed some screening threshold, whatever it is, to identify the areas that might warrant action. In our example, we identified initially 3 different areas. And then you will go back and look at other information related to sediment characteristics, perhaps, you know, the concentration of your contaminants, the type of contaminant, the depth of that contamination, water use features. You know, is this a navigation channel? Do you have groundwater plumes, et cetera? And you're going to refine those remedial zones. And then in our example, we identified 3 remedial zones, remedial zone 1, which was kind of just a broad area, remedial zone 2, which had 3 different areas, and remedial zone 3, which is what we're going to focus on in, where we had, and I think Paul and Steve talked about this, but this is where we've got 3 sub-zones based on infrastructure, you know, this bulkhead, sediment strength, you know, the weight-bearing capacity of the sediments, and then the presence of debris. So getting to the aerial photograph showing this, again, the bulkhead area, the soft sediment and habitat area, and then the debris and deposition area. And so I think, you know, this really shows that, you know, that some of this information, you know, really can be informative in terms of evaluating your technology. So, for example, if you have a lot of debris, if you have infrastructure, you know, like Steve was just talking about the piers at United Hecathorn that may limit your ability to dredge, you know, that needs to be considered as you're evaluating your technologies. If you have areas where you've got that are depositional, you know, that's really going to favor, you know, monitor natural recovery, can favor enhanced natural recovery, and also can favor capping because you might not have to design your cap with a nice armor layer or something like that to withstand erosion. In areas where you have habitat, like Steve mentioned, I think that, you know, if you have a habitat area, you don't necessarily want to come in there and dredge it all up and really, you know, damage the habitat and the ecological resources that you're actually trying to protect. So these are all the things that we're going to, you know, you need to be considering you know, as you're going forward and evaluating your technology. And then we had a screening step. You know, we had the we have a little downloadable spreadsheet that has, you can actually go through in a systematic kind of way, screen your technologies. The results of that for this zone anyway, really retained all the technologies. The only one we didn't retain was excavation in the dry, really because of water depth, because of, you know, water use. You know, if you have navigation areas and things like that, you're not necessarily going to be able to come in there and dewater and excavate in the dry. I think, you know, excavation can work good when you have when you can actually reroute a creek, maybe, you know, that can work, or if you can work during low tide or these kind of things where you can actually get in there and work in the dry. And then we discussed the technology evaluation, you know, so again, after you've done the screening, you go through, as Paul described, and you evaluate these various technologies. And this is really the outcome of that whole process, kind of distilled down into, you know, one small table on a slide. But I think you can see from here that, you know, in general, most of these technologies are, you know, favorable. The only one that really at least stands out to me as being, you know, not too favorable would be hydraulic dredging. I think, you know, because of the potential for debris, maybe because of the lack of access to areas where you can actually go in and dewater those sediments, because when you're doing hydraulic dredging, you're going to really generate a lot of water that's going to have to be managed. But really, all the other technologies are either green or yellow on this slide, and therefore really should be considered as you're moving forward in developing your remedial action alternatives. So when we're thinking about developing our remedial action alternatives, you know, we've gone through, we've figured out which technologies are going to work, and now we need to take those technologies and assemble them into a suite of alternatives for evaluation. So as I noted in the slide previously, you know, we had a large number of these technologies that really were retained. And then the next step is to go and think about, well, are these technologies going to allow us to achieve our remedial action objectives? And at least in this example, we determined that, you know, M&R anyway would not, you know, by itself would not allow us to meet our remedial goals within a reasonable time frame. That we can't, you know, just allowing natural recovery to occur by itself was not going to be effective. Doesn't mean that we couldn't, you know, go with enhanced natural recovery or something like that. But again, for this example, we eliminated M&R because it wouldn't achieve our REOs. And then thinking about, you know, some of the physical constraints. So again, if we have a bulkhead and we're going to try to dredge adjacent to that bulkhead might in fact collapse. And that may, you know, limit our ability, if we're going to retain that bulkhead, to actually get at some of the contamination that we want to get at. So, you know, we determined, again, for this example, that dredging along the bulkhead would not be implementable. So, you know, again, we tried to come up with a range, as we're developing our alternative, a range of technologies that kind of go from least aggressive to most aggressive. And for the example, you know, we have a range here of, you know, treatment and enhanced M&R, which are relatively non-aggressive, I would say, all the way up to, you know, dredging and capping, which are more aggressive. And so we've, you know, built these alternatives, and then we will, you know, again, based on our technologies, based on trying to come up with a range of alternatives that we can evaluate, so we can evaluate the cost and the effectiveness of different things, come up with a range that we can carry forward into the detailed evaluation. So once we have those alternatives, then we move into the next step, which is the evaluation of the alternatives. Now, this is a part of the, I think, the guidance that we struggled a little bit with, because I think John mentioned this in the beginning, that, you know, we have different regulatory environments that people might be working in, or they might be working outside the regulatory environment. So, you know, we didn't want to go to the CERCLA requirements. We didn't want to pick a specific state or something like that. So what we tried to do was come up with some principles, I guess, that we would use for evaluating alternatives. I think it's important to keep in mind that no matter what regulatory program you're in, or whether you're not in a regulatory program, you're still going to want to look at things like long-term effectiveness. You know, is this remedy going to be effective over the long term, not just, you know, after you construct it, but, you know, 10, 20 years down the road. You want to evaluate short-term impact. So if you're dredging, you might have releases during dredging. Again, that may limit the short-term impact or have greater short-term impacts than something like a cap or natural recovery. Then thinking about implementability, both, you know, technical and administrative, and then looking at cost, of course. And as I mentioned, you know, the exact criteria you're going to look at are going to be depending on the regulatory requirements. And then under CERCLA, you know, there are modifying criteria, which include, you know, state and community acceptance. But I think there's other things that you might want to consider as well. Sustainability, that's a big one these days. Another one that's not on here that you might want to think about, too, is that, you know, if you're leaving material in place and capping it, you know, again, there's long-term liabilities associated with managing that, and some, you know, some parties may not be comfortable with that, so that's something to keep in mind as well. So as I mentioned, you know, we came up with these various principles that would guide the evaluation of alternatives, and I think the number one principle is to focus in on the ability of that alternative to achieve your remedial action objectives, and then the degree of net risk reduction you're going to get. So we're not talking about removing mass to remove mass. We're really talking about designing or evaluating alternatives that will, you know, reduce risk. I mean, that's really the primary thing. That's really what, you know, these remedies are all about. The second thing to keep in mind is that, you know, natural recovery is likely a component of all, you know, sediment remedies. It's, unless you're in a really small water body, you know, a small pond or something like that, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to remediate all the contamination because of the costs associated with doing that. So, you know, you're going to allow nature to help you out and to reduce the chemical concentrations. And I think it's safe to say that pretty much all remedies, you know, have some component of natural recovery. Another key component is trying to maximize long-term risk reduction, but at the same time, minimizing short-term impacts. And this, I think the classic example of this is that, you know, dredging versus capping. You know, if you dredge, maybe you're maximizing your long-term risk reduction because you're removing all the contamination, but yet you might be really stirring up the sediments, releasing a lot of contaminants to the water column, to the surrounding water body, and therefore your short-term impacts might be large. If you cap, maybe you're going to minimize those short-term impacts because you're placing sand down. Maybe you don't get a lot of turbidity when you do that, or a lot of release of contamination when you do that. But now you've got the stuff that you have to manage in place over time. So it's just important to keep, you know, kind of try to balance those two things as you're going forward. We did include some graphics in the document to kind of help illustrate some of this stuff. So this kind of looks at really long-term, effectiveness versus cost, and looking at predicted tissue concentrations there on the y-axis and then cost on the x-axis. And then we have a range of alternatives from the no-action alternative through alternative 6. And you can see that, and this is kind of your classic, I think, knee of the curve evaluation, where you try to identify a breakpoint where, you know, your costs are starting to go get really high, but your benefit isn't as great. So you can see that, at least for the first three alternatives, alternatives 1, 2, and 3, you know, the costs are, you know, relatively low compared to some of the other ones, but you're not getting close to your goal. Where now when you look at alternatives 4, 5, and 6, you can see that when you take into account the uncertainty in your predicted fish tissue concentrations, you can see that, you know, you're starting to actually, you have a chance anyway of meeting your remedial goals. And so, you know, when you go through this, you might say, well, you know, alternative 4, you know, maybe that's where we want to be. You know, that really is it's kind of in that break point. You know, we're meeting our goal, but we're not spending $50 million. The other thing to consider, so that's looking at risk reduction and following completion of construction. But as I mentioned, you know, most of these sediment sites have a component of natural recovery. So, in addition to looking at, you know, post-construction risk reduction, if you will, also want to look at the time to achieve protectiveness, recognizing that, you know, we might not be able to get there, you know, with construction alone. So you can see here we have kind of these curves that are showing, you know, reductions in concentrations over time, and we're kind of going this out, going out 50 years here, and you can see that, you know, for some of these alternatives, they really, once you get out, you know, 25, 30 years, they kind of become indistinguishable from one another. And so that's just part of, I think, part of the uncertainty that you have to deal with. You know, this might not be, I mean, this might tell you that, hey, you know, if we go with alternative six, you know, we're pretty confident we can meet our goal after 10 years. But the other alternatives, you know, we might be uncertain as to whether, you know, which one would do better based on this analysis. So that's where we can bring in things like, you know, keep in mind monitoring, adaptive management, things like that that can, you know, perhaps help us out. I think it is difficult, you know, to make these long-term predictions. I think it's important that we really understand, you know, the limitations of that. I think it's a useful tool, but there are limitations. Some other evaluation principles that we came up with. One is addressing areas of contamination that may be ongoing sources. I think there was a question about, you know, source control and that kind of thing. And I think the way we try to look at it is, you know, we have two kinds of sources that we're concerned about. One are those internal sources, in-water sediment sources that might, you know, limit the effectiveness of M&R, and the other might be external or upstream sources, you know, from the watershed. But in any event, you know, we want to control our sources. We want to remove the sources of contamination within the water body such that M&R can occur. So I think if we do, and it's really a balancing act, right? If we remove more of the material in the water body, then M&R, you know, is going to be more effective because we've removed some of those sources. And then again, coupling that with effective source control, you know, then we can have M&R be effective. If we're just going to rely on M&R alone, you know, it may not be effective. I kind of touched a little bit on uncertainty, but I think, you know, that's something that comes up on every project because, you know, people do try to rely on these models that are predicting out 30 years, and I think there are challenges associated with that. So, you know, one option is, well, we're not sure, therefore we're just going to do a very aggressive remedy. But that might not be cost effective. You know, we might be spending more money than we need to. We might be causing more disruption to the water body than we need to. So I think people have tried to come up with alternate approaches where you come in, you remove the obvious source areas, you monitor, you have an adaptive management program that can kind of come back and take care of things that, you know, you maybe you should have taken care of the first time. And, you know, there are downsides to that, you know, additional mobilization, things like that. But, you know, I think it can be a smarter way to go. Another approach is looking at interim and contingent remedies. So this might be, I think a good example is the Kalamazoo River, for example, where we're doing a bunch of removal actions, and then we're monitoring to see how effective they are and what else needs to be done. So, you know, this is, again, using different regulatory tools to help you come up with cost-effective solutions. And then finally, the idea of balancing cost against overall effectiveness. This is something that comes out of the National Contingency Plan, which says that all remedies shall be cost-effective based on a comparison of cost to overall effectiveness, which includes long-term effectiveness, short-term effectiveness, and some other things. But ultimately, you know, we kind of like with that knee of the curve, you know, we don't want to spend tons of money and not get a lot of benefit for it. So, you know, it's kind of a judgment call, I think, you know, as how much money to spend and how much uncertainty you can live with in terms of the effectiveness of your remedy. One thing that we included in the guidance document that can help this evaluation, and I think this is maybe a little controversial, but the idea of doing some kind of cost-benefit analysis where you can look at your different criteria and you weight them in some way, and maybe you assign a numerical score, high, low, medium, whatever it might be, and then you can kind of sum those up, and then you can compare those to cost, and you might be able to get some information that helps you identify what is the most cost-effective, you know, remedy. I think people like this and some people don't, but I think the main message here is that if you look at alternative E, which is the most costly, it doesn't give you the greatest benefit. And so it's just something to keep in mind that, you know, the most costly remedy isn't necessarily, you know, doesn't necessarily have the best benefits as you're doing your evaluation. So just maybe to kind of summarize a little bit in terms of these evaluation principles, you know, the number one thing is that you got to address your specific regulatory requirements. So if you're in, you know, working with EPA or working with a certain state, you know, you're going to make sure, you know, they probably have, well, I know EPA does and a lot of states have, you know, specific criteria that you have to utilize to do your evaluation. The second thing is managing risk, and this is kind of thinking about, you know, uncertainty. You know, how to best manage that uncertainty. Again, when you are relying on natural recovery to some degree for most sites and you have uncertainty about those long-term predictions, you know, what's the best way to manage that in a cost-effective way? I think another important thing is to recognize that for, you know, a lot of water bodies, it's not like, you know, in a water body, it's not necessarily like a single piece of property, a single site, you know, where everything's under control, under your control. Water bodies have a lot of sources that are feeding into them, and so it's important to recognize the role of water quality programs, water quality authorities to control sources, to maybe improve the effectiveness of natural recovery. Again, you know, we talked about the idea of source control being important, but if the sources are, you know, a few miles upstream of your site, and you have no control over them, then you know, you're going to have to rely on other regulatory authorities to control those such that your remedy doesn't get recontaminated. Incorporating green and sustainable remediation concepts, there is an ITRC guidance on this, green and sustainable remediation, and I would just recommend, you know, going to that. I think it's something that we see a lot more of these days where people do take this into consideration during the evaluation of their alternatives. And then finally, incorporating habitat and resource restoration into your evaluation. I think a good example of this is if you're designing a cap, for example, how do you design that cap in a way that, you know, will be effective, will remain in place, will not be eroded during high flow events or storm events or whatever, but at the same time also can provide a suitable substrate for recolonization by the benthic community. And so, you know, really trying to strike a balance between the two and trying to get creative about how you design that cap. Done a lot of work in Portland, Oregon, kind of came up with this idea of using, you know, cobbles as an armoring layer on caps. So, you know, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the trustee agency that, you know, kind of looks at salmon, migratory fish moving through that area, you know, they basically agreed that, you know, this kind of cobble, you know, can be, provide suitable substrate. It's not, you know, it's not like riprap, it's real angular rock, but, you know, it can armor the site, but it can also armor the cap, but it can also, you know, provide some habitat benefits. And so if you can do that, I think, you know, you end up with having a project where not only did you, you know, remediate the contamination, but you did something to improve the habitat. See that often too with as caps kind of can move up a bank. You might have, you know, plantings of native plants and that kind of thing that can prevent erosion and then provide some habitat benefit. So when we kind of went through our whole evaluation, I didn't do this, but you know, we'll go through and we evaluate to our different criteria, and you can see that for these different areas, we came up with three preferred alternatives. And in the bulkhead area, again, we determined that a cap would meet our RAOs. We determined in-situ treatment wasn't really going to be effective enough. We determined that removal wasn't implementable. Therefore, we kind of came up with a cap there. In the soft sediment area, we didn't want to come in and remove the contamination, disrupt the environment. maybe the contaminant levels weren't too high, and we determined that, you know, in-situ treatment would work. And then finally, in the depositional area where we had debris, you know, again, removal wasn't necessarily going to be practical because of the debris, but it was a depositional area, therefore, you know, placement of sand to enhance that natural recovery through deposition, you know, was determined to be an implementable and cost-effective approach. So that's kind of the end of my little session. I'm going to turn it over to Juana, who's going to talk about the monitoring, I believe.
Thank you, Eric. So go to slide 66. So yes, now we'll talk about monitoring. So based on this training so far, and based on our own project experience, we all commonly recognize the need of monitoring at every stage of the project, be it baseline, pre or post-remedy implementation. So while developing this guidance document, the ITRC Sediment Remediation Committee also recognized this importance of developing a monitoring program. So in this monitoring section, slides will go through a planning process that can be used to develop an effective monitoring program. And this ITRC recommended planning approach is based on EPA's data quality objectives process, and it also incorporates EPA sediment remediation guidance, Navy sediment guidance, and other resources, and they are all referred in the guidance document. So for any remedial action, as previously discussed in today's training, be it in-situ treatment, capping, dredging, MNR, or EMNR, monitoring is required at each phase. Baseline monitoring is performed to understand the baseline conditions prior to remedy implementation, and in case of MNR, it is performed before the compliance monitoring plan is implemented. Construction monitoring, it is performed to measure important variables such as turbidity and to determine if the design criteria have been met, and it is not performed in case of MNR as we do not place any technology there, implement any cap or dredge, so it's not applicable in case of MNR. Then post-remediation monitoring, it is performed to determine if the remedy which is selected is performing as expected and to evaluate long-term effectiveness. So we'll go through the details of these monitoring phases as we go through the slides. So here we'll talk about monitoring timeline, and this figure shows how monitoring fits into the overall time frame and emphasize on pre-remedy, remedy implementation, and post-remedy monitoring. But before we go into the details, we would like to distinguish here between characterization efforts and baseline monitoring. Characterization efforts are usually a part of remedial investigation, and it takes place prior to considering any remedial alternatives. And the data needed to understand the risk, to identify the remedial footprints, or to select the remedial alternatives may not have selected the specific metrics or time frames that we may plan to use for evaluation of long-term effectiveness. So basically, characterization efforts are more comprehensive, and we can use the data from characterization efforts in the technology remedial evaluation, as Paul discussed during that worksheet description. But baseline monitoring, it covers specific measures or parameters that we want to focus during our long-term monitoring as well so that we can make proper comparisons. And it can also cover any missing parameters. Usually in case of capping, we need groundwater flux measurements and pool water measurements that are sometimes are not covered under our characterization efforts. So those can be covered during our baseline effort, and that can be used to refine our capping design. Then construction monitoring, it typically takes place during or immediately after remedy implementation, and to determine if the design criteria have been achieved and if the construction specific performance metrics have been achieved, for example, uniform cap thickness, or dredging depth, and it also used to determine if the control measures are met, such as turbidity controls or other water quality parameters. We need to determine that they are at required levels or not. Then post-remediation monitoring, it takes place after remedy implementation and involves regulators and a stakeholders' approval process. And this may include performance monitoring to determine if the physical and chemical conditions that we are trying to achieve with the remedy implementation have been met, such as surface sediment concentrations are now at acceptable levels. And then effectiveness monitoring, it covers long-term data that will show progress towards meeting the actual remedial action objectives. For example, bioavailability of contaminants or ecosystem recovery, these could be the measures that we need to demonstrate to show that remedy has been effective. Now, here we'll start a discussion about the six-step planning process, which was developed for planning and designing the monitoring program. And as I mentioned before, this is based on EPA's data quality objective process and also incorporates EPA sediment remediation guidance, Navy sediment guidance, and other resources. So in this slide, we will discuss about stating the objectives and identifying the measures that are needed using the that need to be answered using the monitoring data to be collected. So we this will help us planning a structured and a strategic, well-thought approach for our monitoring program. What we recommend here is that objectives be stated as a specific questions, and that can be answered using the monitoring data that we are planning to collect. And we should list these questions to be answered for each monitoring phase, baseline, construction, and post-remediation. And once these questions are established, the process requires to determine a specific measurements that will be needed to answer these questions. So in general, these measurements include physical properties, chemical concentrations in various media, and biological characteristics. And in some cases, it may involve biases that can be used to demonstrate the reduction in toxicity over time. Then the specific questions and associated measures, they can vary with site as they depend on unique conditions of each site. So same technique can be relevant for all type of systems like rivers, streams, lakes, ponds. But as Steve mentioned earlier in our training, that physical properties, they vary a lot. So we need to keep that in our mind when we plan our monitoring plan. For example, in lake, tidal fluctuations may not be important, but in some of the rivers or marine systems, it can be a dominating parameter. So that need to be accounted during planning and designing the monitoring plan. Next two steps in this process are to specify the boundaries for the monitoring program and to specify how the measurements are used. So the boundaries explain where we want to sample, what portion of environment we want to sample, and when it will be measured. And most of the time we start planning our monitoring program by talking about frequency of sampling. However, we need to think strategically and plan what we want to represent from that data. So we should start by mapping the remediation zones. Again, it was discussed earlier how zones are defined. So we need to focus on those zones, areas, or portion of environment for which separate conclusions are desired. And this will ensure that adequate data is collected for each such area of interest to support the evaluation of trends over time. For example, taking sediment or pore water samples from top 6 inches of the sediment prior to and after remedy implementation to evaluate the performance of remedy over time. Now, time frames are also very important. So we should consider the temporal component during planning to ensure that samples taken before and after remediation represent the same seasonal patterns. The concentration of some of the contaminants are highly dependent on these seasons and related temperatures. For example, methylmercury production, it increases when temperature rises and in anoxic conditions. So if we try to compare methylmercury data from early summer prior to remediation and compare it with midwinter post-remediation, then it could lead to conclusions that are not really related to remedy performance. So once these spatial and temporal boundaries are defined, the next step is how data will be utilized to satisfy the objective. So we need to specify how data will be analyzed and how findings will result into specific actions. For example, if we are planning to analyze the data using some statistical summaries or we are planning to do some trend analysis, how we want to present that data and utilize that data so that we can demonstrate the performance over time, and how the findings will be employed. For example, if the target levels are not achieved in the given time frame as expected, then do we plan any amendments to the remedy in place, or what actions we will take? So we need to think about such specific actions as well. Then last two steps are to consider uncertainty and designing the monitoring program. So it is very important to think about to have a strong basis for the design of monitoring program and how well it will perform. And it should give us the confidence that we want to see in the performance of remedy over time. And this will avoid consequences of overestimation and underestimation of the remedy performance. So we need to state what changes are meaningful and what we want to see. For example, if we want to see 25% reduction in concentrations of contaminants, and then we also need to define what level of confidence we want to see. For example, 90% confidence or the desired higher confidence based on our remedial action objective. But one more important thing, again, is the timeline, that when do we expect to see this 25% reduction. So we may not be able to achieve this required percentage reduction right after remedy in place or any year after, which will also depend on what kind of metrics we are planning to evaluate. So we need to design the program considering all these factors. So this plan will have information about types of samples, location of samples to represent the area of interest, and frequency and number of samples for each sampling event to achieve the desired confidence. And these specifications will also help statistical design experts or scientists who will be involved in designing the monitoring program so that they can design the plan with required certainties and can avoid underestimation of the remedy performance. Now, here is an example for monitoring measures, and this table illustrates monitoring objectives and measurements for each baseline, construction, and long-term monitoring. That includes both performance and effectiveness monitoring. The objective for baseline monitoring is to establish site-specific baseline conditions. And during construction, objectives are to meet the design criteria and control measures. And then for long-term monitoring, goals are to achieve project-specific remedial action criteria. For example, reduction in contaminant concentrations to improve ecological and human health and overall environmental quality. Then on the right side of the table, these are the examples of all the measures that can be taken, including chemical, physical, and biological parameters to meet the objectives for each monitoring phase. Now, on this slide, I have poll questions to see how many of you have been involved with the fish tissue analysis to monitor the remedy performance. So our first question is, have you been involved in assessing performance based on fish tissue analysis? And if you have been involved in a fish tissue analysis, then did it include mercury, methylmercury, or neither? So I see most of the answers say were not involved. And if they were involved, So we actually we do have an example of fish tissue analysis for mercury on our next slide. So here we have an example of mercury remediation monitoring program using fish tissue, and this chart shows that mercury concentrations in fish tissue on the primary y-axis in blue, and mercury concentrations in the sediment on the secondary y-axis in red over time. And the black dashed line here indicates when the remedy was placed, which is CAP in this case, to compare pre-remedy and post-remedy performance. So here we can see that concentrations in sediments were really high prior to remedy implementation, and shows decrease in concentrations immediately after remedy was in place because we have clean CAP layer. However, the blue fish tissue data shows that fish tissue concentrations have not come down immediately after remedy implementation. And we may see those changes over time when the concentrations in surface sediments remain low, and then the concentrations in fish tissue can go down too, demonstrating the long-term effectiveness of the remedy. So this is a good example for the importance of timeline and what kind of metrics we are planning to evaluate as sediment data reflects decrease in concentrations right after remedy implementation. But for fish tissue data, we need some time so that that equilibrium can exist, and then we can start seeing those reduction in fish tissue concentrations over a period of time. So this is all we have for monitoring section, and with this, I will pass back to John Cargill.
All right, thank you, Bhavna. As you all can see on this slide here, slide 74, we're down at a portion of the document where we talk about stakeholder concerns and then a summary. And you know, we've been in the weeds quite a bit today. We've talked about sites, and which was our goal. We want to talk about remediation of sites. But when we talk about stakeholder concerns, we have to take a little bit more broad context or broader context. I'd like to point out that on this team that we had a community stakeholder and we had a tribal stakeholder who sat through all of the discussions that we had on a technical level, and you know, they were very good about, you know, keeping the scientists in check, so to speak. And the message is really about awareness where they're concerned. And chapter 8 in our ITRC guidance here goes into a lot more detail. And what I'll point out here is that this document exists. It's called the Public Trust Doctrine, a national document. It says that state governments must manage and protect certain natural resources for the sole benefit of their citizens, both current and future. And this came up several times. It kind of puts it out there that we have a responsibility to protect things not just for ourselves but for others. And the stakeholder section we've got in our document here, our guidance document, really identifies the problem that, you know, from a site-related standpoint, you know, risk reduction, you know, at a site alone might not return your resource to a fishable and swimmable condition, which is one of the goals of the Clean Water Act. This section put together by our stakeholders also points out that, you know, partnerships are exceptionally critical And a long-term view of the of your watershed is important. So, you know, I kind of boil this down into some simple words, and really that is think bigger than your site. In you know, to kind of continue with that concept, you know, we've talked about different contaminants today, and we've mentioned PBTs a couple of different times, the persistent, the bioaccumulative, and the toxic compounds. And in many cases, these compounds contribute to, you know, watershed scale impacts, and fish advisories. We go back to the very first slides that I showed, you know, a couple hours ago. And we're talking about things like the Great Lakes or the Chesapeake and some coastal systems, where you can have really large impacts across a very, you know, wide range of places. And there's a need to understand and maybe assess other pathways to our sediment impacts, maybe, for instance, groundwater discharges through the hyporheic zone, surface water drainage pathways, for instance, or maybe other tributaries that drain into the waterway that you're working in throughout the watershed. And really we're talking about the fact that multiple impacts can really have a major, major effect on the economics of a region, the recreational capacity of a region, and in some cases, depending on where you are in the country, you know, subsistence fishing for local communities, you know, or tribes for that matter. So we really have to think regionally in some cases and think about the ecosystem as a whole, and again, understand that, you know, remediation of one site might not be enough to protect the entire ecosystem, but it certainly does help, and we just kind of have to keep our eye on a little bit, you know, bigger prize, if you will. Again, I mentioned that the take-home message from our stakeholders were awareness, and they really drove it home to us as a team, and not that the rest of the team didn't really understand it, but they really drove home the importance of identifying who your stakeholders are, get them on board early in the process, have, you know, resource-driven discussions early and often with your stakeholders in order to really have a cooperative remedy implementation. It's going to go a long way. And, you know, the stakeholders sitting at the table will really kind of help to keep a lot of these ideas on the table when the scientists are discussing parts per billion and 10 to the minus something risk. They're going to kind of help keep us focused on some of the larger scale or more broad concepts that are important to keep in mind. So I refer you to Chapter 8 of our document to gain a better understanding of what our stakeholders had to say throughout this process. So with that, you know, everybody should at this point just take a real deep breath. We've covered an awful lot of information today, and we're done with new concepts or new information. So I'm going to go over a real quick summary, and then we'll take some more of your questions and see if we can answer those before we're off the call today. But very briefly, I just want to point out that we've really only scratched the surface of what's included in this web-based guidance document. There is just an awful lot of information. This morning or earlier today, Steve talked about identifying site characteristics. He talked to us about defining remedial zones and took us through a preliminary screening step in our decision framework. Paul went into a lot of a good discussion on technology assessment guidelines and technology overviews that are contained in the document and the detailed evaluation of site-specific data. Eric got into some details for us on the development of remedial action alternatives, you know, utilizing our tags and a weight of evidence approach and some criteria for evaluation of remedial action alternatives. We've talked about today worksheets that you can use to compile that data and kind of house it and keep it all in one place. Bhavna just went over monitoring considerations that we can take at contaminated sediment sites. And again, I talked very briefly about, you know, public and tribal stakeholder viewpoints that relate to contaminated sediment management. You know, we went into some detail as Paul mentioned about our technology overviews, where we provide links to other recommended and relevant publications, other guidance documents maybe, maybe some case studies that we can link you to through, you know, our point, click, and go functionality that we've got built into this web document. And again, I'll point out our technology assessment guidelines. We spent an awful lot of time as a team going over those things and making sure that we gave appropriate guidelines for folks to use when they're evaluating specific criteria as it pertains to certain technologies that might be applicable to your site. We discussed or hopefully pointed out to you all the advantages of this guidance. You know, I told you early on what I thought they were. I'll reiterate that. We've got an online interactive guidance, a one-stop shop, if you will, that you can just point, click, and go to the most relevant information that you're looking for. You really don't have to scroll through tons and tons of verbiage to find what you need. We pointed out that our technology selection and evaluation that we've presented is driven by site-specific data. Again, very important to everybody on the team that that a decision is driven by the data that you have that's applicable to your site, and not a necessarily a textbook value or an assumption. We covered all available remedial technologies that exist to date. Maybe in the future we'll add some other ones as things are more available or become available, but we think we've included everything that is available to date. Again, providing you information through our tags to inform those evaluations. And lastly, I mentioned it early on, and I'll do again, the case studies that we have in this document. They're buried in the back in an appendix, but don't lose sight of that. You know, over 80 case studies summarized is an awful lot of information for you to reference, and we've provided contacts for you to contact the folks that have either managed that site or are regulating that site that you can call on for more information. And at the end of all this, I hope at this point you agree with us that you'll be better prepared to identify, evaluate, and apply. Again, meaning identify the essential site-specific data and information you need to evaluate a remedy for your site, evaluate the particulars of all the technologies, and apply the current emerging methodologies and techniques that are out there to your site. Most importantly, we want you all to use the document, and we'd also request that you let us know if you like the document. If you find it useful, let us know if you didn't find it useful, and it's important information for us, too, as a team. So with that, I'll thank all of you for joining us today. I hope you gained something from this course, and we'll recommend it to some other folks. And at this point, I believe we'll take some more questions and answers. Juliana?
Thanks, John. We're also going to have another poll coming up. Would you recommend using the framework described today? And thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance document? So we have both those set so that we can share our answers with others in the audience. We do have a little bit of time for questions, so you're welcome to send in a question. I'll also point out our links to additional resources and also the link to the feedback form. If you complete the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to certify that you participated, you can create a certificate of participation for yourself. So if that's something that you are interested in, be sure to fill out that feedback form, check the box at the bottom. The next page is going to have a PDF where you can download that, or it's going to be emailed to you if you supplied your email address. If you forget to check the box at the bottom, just go back and do it again. The only way to get that certificate right now is when you fill out the feedback form and the system is going to generate it for you. We had a question that came in earlier. How would the trainers recommend secondary technology process options be handled during the screening and alternative development? For example, there are options for disposal following removal, such as CDF, CDA cells, or landfill for materials, or for material transportation, such as barges, trucks, and rails. At some sites, there may also be multiple options for water treatment. These don't fit into the existing ITRC tables and are often handled in different ways in RIFS documents for different sites.
Yeah, Juliana, Paul Duty here, if you guys can still hear me.
Yeah.
I had provided a response to that, I think, the online question, but in essence, it raised a very good point that level of granularity and screening is not directly covered in the spreadsheet tool that I had walked through. But those elements are described in the guidance, and those kind of associated technologies with with dredging primarily, where the examples that were thrown out there are provided in the sediment removal section. But yeah, the assumption is that the user would have done that screening as part of or in conjunction with the kind of development of what a sediment removal option would look like that would go into the table 2.5 that I had provided as an example. So it's a good point that was raised, and that is not directly covered in the spreadsheet tool, but certainly the topics are discussed and described in the guidance itself.
Thank you. We are out of time for today's class, so if you have questions that we didn't get to, you're welcome to send those to me, training@itrcweb.org, or you can respond to any of your confirmation or reminder emails, and we'll follow up with trainers to ask for answers for those questions. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out that feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us more information. You are welcome to visit the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.